Right, so let's get on with today's interview. I'll give you Andrew Johnson. Other than seeing a UFO when I was younger, the space side of things has passed me by a little bit. I mean, I watch a little bit of this, you know, Musk thing, and I watch a bit of this, you know, these rockets that can land now and all that. And it's all good. I mean, it looks fantastic, but I know, you know, I know that that's just got to be propaganda because it's you know, in the loosest sense of the word, if you like, but it's got to be more to it than that, because I know that spaceship I saw, and that's what I call it, a spaceship. Was either alien or it was man-made, and either one of those possibilities, because it was definitely there, so either one of those possibilities is has interesting connotations. And obviously, you've wrote this book now, the Finding the Secret Space Program. So that's what you're here to talk about. So I guess the first question, the obvious question, is did we go to the moon? Well,
the way that I answer that is that what was shown as regards the Apollo missions as being a landing, that wasn't real. It was shot in a studio. So that's a slightly different answer to saying, well, you know, there could have been moon missions, but it wasn't. They didn't go with an Apollo Saturn V rocket, and they didn't land on the moon in the Grumman lunar module. That didn't land on the moon. So that part of it was all staged, basically. And I think, you know, I'm reasonably convinced that some astronauts went up into what you'd call low Earth orbit, which is basically below 400 miles above the Earth's surface. So, you know, as far as I can tell from everything that I've looked at, the missions which, you know, are destined for that sphere, in other words, within that sphere of going up to 400 miles above the Earth's surface, I think all those missions are real, and they've been real since sort of early 60s. For the most part. I mean, there's a couple of sort of caveats to that. But when you go outside of that region, that things, you know, for certainly for manned spaceflight become much more problematic for various reasons.
Absolutely. I mean, I go along with that. I believe that the rocket, you know, the rockets possibly took off and all the rest, that could have all been real. No issue with that. I think, obviously, the astronauts landing on the moon, that's a separate problem, and then with all that goes with it. Now, the International Space Station, this throws up a bit of controversy, and I'm not really sure why. I think that's, even with the technology that we've got now, it's well doable.
Yes.
And you can look up in the night sky, you can get the app, can't you?
That's right,
the tracker.
Yeah, that's what I tell people.
Yeah, and you can watch it, and it's there. As far as I can tell, that's real. So I don't really know why that's so controversial. But then, obviously, you've got people who believe in the flat Earth, so anything's possible.
Well, that's it. Well, this is actually deliberate, and that's, see, what's happened, if you think about, you know, the way what I've put in the book, this Finding the Secret Space Program book, and that's available as a free download from my website. So I advise anyone that's listening to go and download that and read it, or if you want to buy a paperback copy, you can from the usual places. But it is a free download, and that's deliberate on my part.
I was going to ask you about that just before you carry on there. Why is it free? Because obviously you've put a lot of time and effort into this.
Two reasons, really. I get rather tired of criticism being levelled at this sort of research has been just to make money. Now, it's not one that's been levelled at me personally very often, but once I say, well, I'm giving that away free, that destroys the argument completely. And secondly, then the only reason nowadays, I mean, most people have got smartphones, you know, you can get a smartphone now secondhand for 10 quid, and you can, you know, go to a supermarket, plug into the, you know, charger into a port, charge up for nothing, access their free Wi-Fi, download it and read it. So, you know, you get into the point where you can get this information for free as long as you know how to get it. So the only excuse then is one of time or reluctance to learn things you didn't know before. which is the big problem generally.
Absolutely.
So that's really the answer to that question. But so what I've put in the book, I argue, if you look at the dates of things, like, for example, if you go back to your, talking about the UFO issue, and I'm pretty convinced that the Roswell incident was real and that a craft did crash there and there were beings, that came out of that. The stories differ quite a bit, but I do, from what I've read and the evidence and the testimony, bodies were recovered either from Roswell or from an event which happened around that time, or both. And you can read up on that separately. And that was 1947. And then it was 10 years later that Sputnik went around the Earth, and everyone picked that up on their radios. So we know that that was there. It was picked up, going round and round the planet in 90 minutes. And so that was 10 years later. And then 1961, we allegedly had the Yuri Gagarin in space. And if you look at that mission, again, there's doubts that he actually went up. And I think that was also a stunt, a propaganda stunt, if you look. And I've put that in the book as well. So what I think happened, basically, in summary, is that they had the Roswell stuff and other stuff as well. There's quite a lot of other stuff going on around that time. There was another crash at Aztec, which has been very well documented by Scott Ramsey.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting book. He doesn't sort of go beyond what the evidence of that incident shows you. But again, bodies were in that craft and people went inside of it, and there's witnesses, corroborating testimony. There's a mysterious road in the middle of this sort of desert area in Aztec, which, this road shouldn't be there. And there's a ramp, where they appeared to have built this ramp to recover this craft and stuff. It's all in his book, basically. So my point of mentioning that is that they'd got this technology, the military had got it, and they started to develop it. And, so there were other things going on as well. Obviously, there's people like Nikola Tesla had done research in the 1920s into what you might call anomalous energy effects. And then there was research going on into anti-gravity in the 1950s. And then the talk of that all stopped in about 1956, which was the year before Sputnik. And then after 1956, it was all chemical rockets. And we basically heard, in the mainstream, we've heard nothing but chemical rockets since 1956. And if you read Nick Cook's book, The Hunt for Zero Point, which I reference quite a bit in my book, you'll see that it appears that this anti-gravity research went underground around about 1956. That's what he sort of more or less concluded, and I agree with him. So you've got, I think what was happening there is, we've got to get some type of space program going here, because all these scientists are thinking about space, and we've got all these science fiction films about aliens coming out, so we need to get people's minds focused on something. And I think the chemical rocket space program, which of course came out of the German V2 program, or a lot of it, from the end of the Second World War. And so they developed this chemical rockets program, and then they continued to use that as propaganda into Apollo, because Apollo was going on during the time of the Vietnam War. So everyone was thinking the US was pretty terrible for what they were doing in Vietnam. So they had this Apollo program going on as a sort of, a positive spin on the future. And there was that angle of it as well. But when it was taking off, all the attention, all these scientists, that were thinking about space and advanced technology would be looking at the Apollo program and talking about that, being involved with that, being interested in it, writing papers about it and all of that sort of thing. So it was all, I think, as well, whatever else it was a cover for the secret space program. And I go into some of the evidence for that in the book. And, for example, the projects of Victor Schauberger, who was he was a forestry worker, actually, but he was also he developed a device that he called a repulsine, which was a unit which you could it was a water implosion unit, and you would put water inside it and spin it, and then it would generate some type of strange implosion effect, which would then create levitation. And there's quite a bit of evidence that this thing did actually work, and it was funded by the Nazis in their secret research program. Much of that is in Nick Cook's book. So that was one example where they were building some type of anti-gravity craft, and it wasn't based on chemical rockets, and I don't think that one particularly was based on field effects either, which was what was another branch of the research that was based on what might be called field effects.
Yes.
And so that was all going on in the 40s and 50s in secret. And then we've got this, a lot of people talk about the Nazi Bell. You might have heard of this Nazi Bell project.
Yeah, De Glocken,
yeah. De Glocken, yeah. And, I mean, Joseph Farrell's written a lot about that. But I looked at that again. I was sort of a little bit sort of not exactly sceptical. I think it's clear that something was going on with that project, and it was this place in Poland. I forget the name of it now, but it's in the book. And Nick Cook went out there with Igor Witkowski in the early 2000s, and they went to this site, which was had this kind of they called it the flytrap, and it was this sort of circular henge structure. And they reckon that this was where part of the Bell system was developed, you know. And anyway, so he was sort of alluding to the fact that this Bell device was an anti-gravity device because, there was some type of large power plant next to it, and it used mercury, and it generated strange effects and had effects on people around it, and they put things like plants around it, flowering plants, and they all died and things like that, some type of radiation coming off it. But when I'd been through the evidence again and done another little bit of research, which wasn't in Nick Cook's book, I came to the conclusion that the Bell wasn't an anti-gravity device or a propulsion device, but it seemed to be an early type of fusion reactor. I think that's what it was. And the people that were involved with it, because there were a couple of people that were connected to it, one of them, he actually went to work in Argentina in the 50s for the Argentinian regime, and he was involved in building them a nuclear reactor, which was never built in the end, but they did, get funding going and stuff. And that's pretty well documented if you go and look for it. So I think that Bell thing was actually some type of, nuclear reactor that they were trying to build and experiment with. And I don't think it was an anti-gravity device. It's possible that it generated, because of the way it worked, it might have generated some sort of anti-gravity effects of some kind, but it certainly wasn't something that you could put in a flying saucer and take off with, from what I've been able to determine.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
And there's quite, this is where you get into a lot of disinformation has been circulated. So people will say, the Kecksburg incident from 1967, I think it was. I always forget whether it's 67 or 65. And it was this acorn-shaped craft that was apparently recovered from the forest and was taken on a flatbed truck. And there's lots of witnesses to that incident. It's a very well-documented incident that people were saying, oh, yeah, that's the same shape as the Nazi Bell, so therefore that must have been the latest version of it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, we're talking like 20 years apart.
Yeah.
You know, you're telling me that they didn't develop something else in 20 years. You know, you've got to sort of think about the pattern of things and the dates of things more carefully, I think, before you jump to conclusions.
Well, that's the biggest problem with the space race as it stands, from the outside, from our point looking at it, we see these rockets and we see apart from these rockets now which can land themselves and all this and reusable rockets, we don't really see any massive leaps in technology.
No.
Which kind of stands out like a sore thumb, doesn't it?
It does, and there's a lot of psychological operations going on now. We record this in May 2019. We're very close to the 50th anniversary of the alleged first landing, and even the other day, on I think it was the day before yesterday, they had thing with Michael Collins on. They had a little few words. They've got some BBC thing coming up, 13 minutes to the moon or something,
yeah,
and they had Michael Collins saying, "Oh, we did go, we did go, we did this great thing, we did go," and he said, "We did go" about three times.
Yeah, yeah, just to make sure that you believe.
Right, right, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, here we go.
Surely you don't need to say that if...
Correct.
You know,
And of course, going back to the Apollo thing a little bit, Richard D. Hall did an interesting bit of research where he got an interview between Patrick Moore and Neil Armstrong, both of whom are no longer with us, of course, that was done in 1970. It was, I think, a seven-minute interview, and he got that analysed by Peter Hyatt, who's a professional statement analyst, who he trains people in law enforcement, investigators, to improve their questioning techniques. So they do this statement analysis where they look at the choice of words, they look at the tenses used, they look at whether the person is using first person, third person.
They can tell if someone's being deceitful.
Exactly. And he, he'd never applied this to the Neil Armstrong interview that Peter Hyatt, he's an American guy. And he actually did this to the interview with his own technique in a dispassionate way, in an objective way. And at the end, he was rather surprised because he said that Armstrong wasn't connecting himself to being on the moon. He was talking about going to the moon and what it was like, but he wasn't connecting himself personally enough to that description. So that made him very, very suspicious that he was telling a story, and the story wasn't the true story. We've got this 50th anniversary approaching, and we're going to see more and more of this. But there's still, there's a fair number of people no longer believe this, and so they've got to try and get around that some way. And of course, the bigger we give you, as you more or less said, really, is the I mean, they haven't even gone back. The last landing there was 1972. And look at look at what mobile phones can do compared to what a pocket calculator could do in 1972.
I mean, I obviously, the playing devil's advocate, I have heard people say, there's no reason to go back. We could be looking further afield, Mars, etc. So,
right.
That holds a little bit of water.
I agree. I think it does hold a little bit of water in that, there's no apparent commercial will to go again, really. But there's no political will. But then again, why was the political will in the 60s? What caused that political will to appear, when we had all that strife in Vietnam, and everything else that was going on, and much of Europe was still really recovering from the Second World War, and stuff, and we had communism in Europe, in a big way, in West Germany and everything. So you could argue that there wasn't really any reason to go in the 1960s, really.
Absolutely.
But they did, allegedly did. They came out with this story. So, these arguments, you can make them, but they did the space shuttle, didn't they? Why do that? Why just send this thing up into orbit? What was it for? You could launch satellites with rockets, and get them into orbit. Most of the satellites that have gone up now have gone up by rocket. They didn't go up in the shuttle, So, you start looking into this and you realize that there is a lot more going on in the background. But going also, on a parallel thread, if you look at the anti-gravity stuff, there's quite a bit of interesting things that come out of looking in those areas. For example, one of the people that I've written about is a chap called Bruce De Palma. And he was a physicist. He did his degree at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, I think. He started to develop a free energy device in the 1980s. It was called the End Machine, and you can see the demonstration of this on YouTube, actually, from around about 1980, 1981. And he got this thing working, and it was producing, I think, something like 1,000 amps of current at 1 volt, which is the opposite sense in which most generators work. You normally get like a current of 10 amps being produced by a generator with, say, 200 volts, rather than, 1 volt and 1,000 amps. So this worked the other way around. But this was publicly demonstrated, and it was over unity. In other words, he was getting out in total a lot more energy than he was putting in. And he says in one of his video clips, I've used this video clip in my presentations, it's a very significant clip, that when he was putting out that he built this device and he was getting some interest from the government, he was visited by none other than Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who was allegedly the sixth man to walk on the moon, or the sixth man not to walk on the moon, as I call him. And apparently Mitchell offered De Palma $30,000 for the device, and they offered, $30,000 a year. It's in this letter that De Palma posted. It's on his website. And De Palma refused because he realised he was getting a crappy deal, you know, and he was saying, that's crap, I'm not going to do that. And Mitchell said to him, well, if you're going to go round in Southern California doing things like this, you're going to get your head blown off.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, De Palma said, you know, he was terrified at that point because this was basically a threat,
yeah.
You know. And then we have on Mitchell particularly, because what really irritates me is that because Edgar Mitchell said something about aliens and crash flying saucers in the, I think it was in the 1990s when he came out with this book. I think it was the book The Way of the Explorer, 1996 book. And he said that he knew people that had been involved with Roswell and stuff, and that, you know, these bodies have been recovered, da-di-da. And loads of people had already said this before Mitchell, you know.
Yeah.
Years before him, sort of 10 and 15 years, and it was Stanton Friedman, of course, who's recently passed on, that uncovered a lot of that information in 1978. And then Mitchell comes along, and everyone's saying, oh, isn't he great that he's come out with all of this? But then if you go and watch Bart Sobrell's film, Astronauts Gone Wild, or A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon. In fact, I've watched both of them if you haven't already. You will see that Mitchell is confronted by Sobrell and says, you didn't walk on the moon. And at first, Mitchell is quite, accommodating, and then he becomes very aggressive. And he actually kicks Sobrell up the backside and kicks him out of the house.
Yeah.
And Sobrell's got his camera running, you know, and they go back to the car. And he says, Mitchell says to his son, Adam, should we go and get a gun and shoot him? You know, yeah. He actually says that, and that's recorded on camera. So we've got a threat to Bruce De Palma in 1980 and a threat to shoot Bart Sobrell in 1998. Yet this Mitchell guy is still a hero of the UFO disclosure movement, apparently. Or posthumous hero, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, he seems to be more muddy in the water, shall we say,
right,
than anything.
That's exactly what he's doing. And he admitted on camera in the 2013 documentary, The Secret Life of Uri Geller, which you can watch on Uri Geller's website in the 90-minute version, not the 60-minute version. Mitchell admitted that he worked for the CIA in 1970 and he reported to George Bush Sr. And he says that on camera.
Do you think it's possible he is a bit of a fantasist as well, though?
I don't know, but I think what happened to him was that he underwent some type of mind control. And this actually sort of came out, that the astronauts... There's this story which came out, I think, in 2014, because I put this in the Secret Space Program book, that they had to hypnotize Pete Conrad because he was swearing too much when he was doing his moonwalks.
Okay.
And they couldn't have this going out live, so they had to hypnotize him to stop him swearing. That was, you know, and it's on the, it's, you know, this was referenced from the Smithsonian website, you know, which is the American Museum. And I think this was a bit of a sort of disinformation story, because I'd read prior to that all of the astronauts underwent some type of mind control program in the 60s. And I think the reason why they did that was to make them believe they walked on the moon. They'd be stupid not to have done that. We know that MKUltra was going on. That all came out in the early 70s. Robert McNamara admitted they, you know, shredded a little, burnt a lot of the documents. That's in the court record. I reference those links in the book for anyone that wants to go and look at those documents. So what they did was they developed this Apollo fantasy. They hypnotized, or whatever you want, or brainwashed the astronauts to believe it. And I think if you watch the way that Mitchell behaves, particularly in this thing with Sobrell, you can see the conflict. You can see that there is conflict in that he really believes he went to the moon, but in one sense, he knows he can't have been to the moon.
Yeah.
And this comes out, and this is why there's this aggressive conflict. And this is not limited to people like Mitchell. You know, we've seen it in the music industry as well with people like Britney Spears. You know, again, if you watch the interview with Britney Spears and Diane Sawyer, where Britney Spears just kind of at one point in the interview, she starts talking in a different voice and she has this really weird turn. And then she starts sobbing in the middle of the interview as if somebody just come into the room and started speaking to her. And it appears to be after Diane Sawyer has used a trigger word, where she says, oh, you've had this spasm of publicity, which is a very unusual phrase, a spasm of publicity. And right after Diane Sawyer says that in the interview, Britney Spears kind of goes into this weird behavior and starts tilting her head from side to side and saying, hello, hello, oh, hello. And it's the weirdest thing.
I'll have to watch that, yeah.
Yeah, and also we saw this with, I think Katy Perry recently shaved all her hair off as well.
Yeah.
So this, and Britney Spears shaved her hair off as well. And it's alleged that a lot of these people that were involved in this breakfast club, Britney Spears being one of them, which was this Disney thing, they were part of a mind control child, sort of paedophile type ring, you know. And it would not surprise me.
No.
And I think that they use these programs on the periphery to get the propaganda to strengthen it, you know, to make it more powerful and to get it into more people's minds. And again, I think the astronauts were subjected to a version of that because they needed to do that. And there's another thing. If you read, going back to Mitchell, he was asked in 1996 on an interview with Richard Hoagland, he was asked what it felt like to walk on the moon. And he said, well, I didn't think that was a relevant question. But people kept asking me this question. So he said, I had to get help. I had to go to my friend, Bob, I think he says his name. He gives his name, who was a hypnotherapist. And Mitchell said, I need to know, you need to help me know what it felt like to walk on the moon, you know, because I didn't know. And that's the weirdest thing to say.
Yeah, that's so strange.
And that's in the book. But a similar thing happened with Buzz Aldrin, because Buzz Aldrin, after he came back from the moon, you know, they allegedly came back from the moon, he had serious problems with his mental health and he was taking Ritalin. And he says that in his first book, he describes that. And the same situation happened with him. He said he was doing an interview, this was, I think, in 1975, and this journalist rang him up and says, oh, can we do this interview, you know, in your hotel room? He says, yeah, but what are you going to ask me? And then he says, well, you know, I'm going to ask you about what you did on the moon. He says, okay. And he says, the first question he got was, what did it feel like to walk on the moon? And Buzz Aldrin said that he broke out in a cold sweat and he had to leave the room. Yeah. And that's in his book. That's in his own book. And I had to go and check that because that was described in Bill Kaysing's book, We Never Went to the Moon. And I had to get a hold of a copy of Aldrin's book to see if that's what he actually said, and he did. It's in his book. I referenced that in my book as well. So, to me, you know, the whole Apollo program was a cover for something else, and it was a way of also getting money from the government and siphoning this off into black programs, you know, which were just developing some of the technology. That I think now has been, it was probably, it may well have been perfected as early as the beginning of the 1960s. I'm not sure of the date. And they had their own craft, perhaps. I think they certainly had them by the 1970s, but it's possible they had them as the early as the 1960s. So, you know, I go into some of that in the book as well. That's in the sort of second half.
So this space program then, you know, the research you've done, what do you think its ultimate aim is, and how many countries do you think are involved in it?
Well, that's more difficult to say from what I've researched. And again, you're getting a lot of stories coming out now. You might have come across these stories by Corey Good. There's another one called Captain K that came out a few years ago. Andrew Battiago was another one that came out 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. I mentioned some of these people in the book. And, you know, they talk about there being a you know, sort of war, people on Mars, you know, and there's a war between groups on Mars and Earth and stuff, and some people talk about going out to Uranus and Neptune, you know, and there's a space fleet out there somewhere parked up or something, you know, but these are just stories. These are just stories, really. We don't really know, from what I've researched, what form the secret space program takes. So I don't know. I don't really know what it's for. I suspect that what it, part of it might be, again, and you have to look at the context of everything else that's been going on in the last sort of 20 or 30 years. There is a group of people that are largely in control of the main affairs on this planet. You know, you can call them Freemasons, you can call them Zionists, you can call them, you know, Bilderbergers, you can call them people that are in the Vatican, you know, the secret groups in the Vatican, the Council of 300. They go under various names. I don't know who they are. I don't know which, if all these groups are involved or if it's one of them or whatever it is. But we know that they are trying to keep us in a certain state of mind, in a certain state of consciousness, and they're trying to keep us in, you know, controlled in some way. And if they weren't trying to keep us controlled, for example, they wouldn't be lying to us about climate change constantly and, you know, pushing all this fossil fuel technology on us when it's perfectly clear now that this is totally irrelevant, you know. So I think if there is a secret space program, it's possible that there are other agencies coming to the Earth which they are trying to reduce or stop their influence. And the other thing, the other possibility is that, and this is what comes into my latest book, which is called Acknowledge, which is about the specifically about the UFO, you know, issue. And that's a free download as well, because I've got three books, really, that sort of go together. There's the Finding the Secret Space Program, there's the Secrets in the Solar System, and there's the Acknowledge book. And there's a bit, quite a bit of crossover between them, because I do think they, you know, they're all part of the same thing, really. And going on to that side of things, and I wasn't really sure whether to believe this at first, but there was talk that President Dwight Eisenhower, he had a meeting with aliens, and the dates differ, but there were two in 1954. One was at Holloman Air Force Base, and one was at Edwards Air Force Base, I think. And I wasn't really sure whether to believe these stories at first, but having gone through the evidence, there are several witnesses that have come forward. You know, I wouldn't say this is like really, really reliable, but I think there's enough consistency in it to say that this probably did happen, and that there was a meeting between Eisenhower and some aliens, and possibly two different types of aliens. There were the Nordic types and the Grey types, and they made an agreement with Eisenhower that, and if you watch, and Bill Cooper's got a talk on this, he talked about this in his 1989 lecture. And he said that there was a meeting between Eisenhower and these aliens, and the aliens said to him, look, we'll give you this technology if you allow us to abduct some people. We'll tell you how many people we're going to abduct. You know, it won't be that many, but you have to keep our presence on Earth a secret. And that's what they told him, apparently. And if you look at everything else that's happened, you look at the cattle mutilations, you look at the evidence for the abductions, which I think is, you know, it's a very I've gone into that in the Acknowledge book as well. It's a complex thing. That to me would explain a lot of what's happened, in that this group of aliens did do something. The US military and whoever have joined with them have wanted to, you know, try and sort of stop the aliens' influence as much as they can, but at the same time, you know, they don't want to tell us about it, and they don't want to involve us in all of that. They just want to keep us ignorant of the whole thing and build their own power base. That's what I think is going on. And part of the reason why I say that is to do, for example, with what Bill Cooper said. Now, Bill Cooper, I don't think got everything right, but I think he got a lot right. He, for example, predicted in 2001. He predicted in I think June or July that something was going to happen, and they were going to blame it on Osama bin Laden because his name was being put out in the media, and that was 3 months before 9/11.
Yeah.
Cooper predicted that, and he was right. November 2001, Cooper's dead. And what he said was, he talked about this meeting with Eisenhower and the aliens and a lot of other stuff as well. And Cooper saw a craft diving into the sea and coming out again when he was in the Navy. He tells that story in his book, Behold a Pale Horse, which is a bit, his book's a bit all over the place, but it's an interesting book nevertheless. But another thing that I put in the Acknowledged book, which I was very interested in, was that Cooper said that the story in the film E.T. the Extraterrestrial, and he said, Cooper said this in 1989, he may have said it before then, but I know he said it in 89 because it's on a YouTube video of a lecture he did in Arizona in 1989. You can watch the whole thing. It's 3 hours long. He said that the story of E.T. was true, but it didn't happen to a little boy. It wasn't a little boy. The character that sort of looked after the alien and was an Air Force officer. They signed this Air Force officer to look after the alien, I think it was in 1954. And according to Cooper, this alien died, and the Air Force guy had become so attached to the alien that the Air Force officer cried. Right? Now, Cooper told that story in 1989. 2011, I reference an interview with, and this story had been knocking around for years, but the interview was recorded in 2011, even though Steven Spielberg had said it in a few years prior to that, and this was on Grant Cameron's site originally, but I've got the recording, or you can find it online. Spielberg's interviewed, and he's asked about the E.T. film, and he says to the interviewer, "I was in the White House, the president had asked me to bring the film to the White House, and he said to me that there aren't 10 people in this room who know that everything on that screen is true." And that's what Reagan said to Spielberg in the White House. And Spielberg said he said it as a joke, but he wasn't laughing and he wasn't smiling. So that, to me, again, that story came, that was Spielberg in 2011, backing up what Cooper had said in 89 and before. So that's why I think you've got two totally different sort of separated stories by years, separate sources, separate people saying the same thing. So I think that is probably true.
Yeah. What about this weird disclosure? Obviously, there's a few countries that are a bit more disclosed than others on the UFO phenomenon, Belgium, etc. So what stops, because I don't, you know, I've heard about these meetings and all this with the Americans and
right.
why it's always the Americans, but what stops these other countries coming out with this information?
Well,
if
I
they're
think,
not privy to this meetings, etc.
Well, I think the disclosure that's happening is a kind of a fake disclosure, or it's kind of it's a disclosure which doesn't really mean much in that, yeah, okay, they're disclosing, for example, that they've got secret documents where they've tracked objects on radar. You know, if you look at what's been put into the public domain documents wise, the categories are fairly limited. They've disclosed, for example, things like radar and visual sightings. They've happened. They've disclosed that. They've disclosed, you know, sightings by aircraft personnel. They've disclosed, for example, the Japan Airlines case. In 1986, John Callahan's talked about that publicly. So they've disclosed some of that, and you know, I think I'll give a few examples in the Acknowledged book. But they haven't disclosed things about things like landings. They haven't disclosed interactions with aliens. That's not come out of anywhere. We've still only got that through people like John Lear, Bill Cooper, you know, and a few others. So that's at a different level. So the disclosure is being controlled. And if you read the Acknowledged book, you'll see who it's being controlled by. It is being controlled by the likes of Stephen Bassett, who runs this Paradigm Research Group, and Stephen Greer. Yeah. And I've got a whole chapter about Stephen Greer in the Acknowledged book, which anybody who's listened to Stephen Greer, I highly recommend that they go and read that chapter about Stephen Greer. And why they're not disclosing the truth about the UFO issue are reasons that Stephen Greer started to talk about in 2001, but now doesn't really talk about. The first one where we're not getting the proper, honest, truthful, full disclosure is energy.
Yeah.
Because when it is disclosed that these craft have landed, they've started to take them apart. They've started to back engineer the propulsion systems. And Greer was talking about this in 2001. It would have to come out that we've cracked the anti-gravity problem. It would have to come out that there is no need for any type of fuel to be used to generate energy. You know, you don't need nuclear reactors. That would have to be disclosed. And
yeah. You'd be talking about billions of people out of work overnight.
Well, not necessarily that. It's more that the greedy businessmen...
Well, that as well, yeah.
You know, and then people talk about, for example, Zionists running big business... You know, because they've done that since the sort of, you know, since they started inventing fiat currency and stuff in the whenever it was in medieval times or whenever, even before then, probably, that'd all have to change. So all the big business and commercial and economic, interests would have to change, right? So the way governments work would completely change. The way that religions work would change. The way that banks work would change. Banks would wouldn't exist. And the way I like to think about that, if you think about the whole UFO thing from the point of what folks like you and I have seen, we've pretty much seen isolated craft. You know, maybe you might see like three or something. Some people might see two, three, four, five objects. But we tend not to see whole fleets of these things, do we? You know, they're not...
Yeah.
You know, coming in to do things. We tend to see them ones, twos, you know, mainly ones and twos, really, maybe ones, actually.
Yeah.
So I think... I think these are just geezers knocking around the universe. They've got their own flying saucer. Yeah. They don't need a government. You know, they don't need any of that stuff. They're totally self-sufficient. They might have a ship where they go back to and hang out, you know. But they don't need any of that stuff. They're totally free. They're totally free. All the trappings that we have, they just don't need that stuff. They've no need for it. So that if that's how our lives could what they could become if there was full disclosure. But as things work now in the whole world, we're part of a mass consciousness. You know, people so most people don't have so few independent thoughts, you know, that everything is put into them from media, TV, from religion, you know, all this sort of thing. And some people struggle even to survive. You know, they don't have clean water. They don't have any food. You know, how many, what is it, 2, 3, 4 billion people don't have clean water, you know, basic human need. All that would change if it was shown to us that we can solve the gravity problem. You know, we don't need roads. We don't need any of that. We can have as much energy as we need. And the people that are covering that stuff up is Stephen Greer. And you see what's happened, and this is why I've written all these books, is they've not, they know about this energy, they know about gravity, but what have they done with it? Yes, they've built spacecraft, which they don't tell us about, but the other thing that Stephen Greer will not talk about, Stephen Bassett will not talk about, Joseph Farrell won't really talk about it, these prolific authors. In fact, all of the UFO movement won't talk about, Colin Andrews won't talk about it, I write about him in the book, they won't talk about the weaponization of this technology. That's what they won't talk about.
Yeah.
Because all this technology, I'm sorry to say, folks, has been weaponized. And that one of the example usage of that weapon was on 9/11. They used it to destroy the World Trade Center. And that is what came out in Dr. Judy Wood's book. And it started to come out in 2006. And I was right in the middle of all of that. And that's what my other two books are about, which, again, are all free, about the two 9/11 books. So... And I, you know, I've got evidence, for example, that Greer knows what happened on 9/11. I'm pretty sure that Greer knows exactly what happened. He knows the people. And I lay out in that chapter where I think Greer fits into that picture. And I could be wrong. I'm certainly not wrong about what he says, because what he says is in his book, and you can go and read it in his book. But my conclusions about what he said might be slightly wrong. But what I know is he's covering up what happened on 9/11. And he basically is asked a direct question by somebody, and I know who that was, actually, a chap that's writes to me occasionally. He was asked a question in 2015 after a three-hour lecture about directed energy weapons, which is what they used to destroy the World Trade Center. And Greer basically ducked the question, and he went into this big, long explanation. And you can tell from his response that he couldn't give a truthful answer. Mm. You know, whatever his reasons, which I don't really excuse, you know. And then you find, for example, if you read Greer's book, which is called Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, or Forbidden Truth, Hidden Knowledge, Greer went to live in Israel for 3 years. And he doesn't say why. You know, I didn't know that until I read it in his book. He just mentions it in like one line.
Oh, yeah.
So what's that about? And so there's a Zionist thread running through things. But of course, if you start talking about that, you get labeled an anti-Semite and you're out, you know. So, and it's not just them. It's bigger than that. One of the things, for example, that Greer's talked about is a company called Science Applications International Corporation. And he talked about it because his witnesses talked about it. And a chap called Bobby Ray Inman, who was, he was a military guy, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, so I think he must have been in the Navy.
Okay.
And he's not still knocking about, is Bobby Ray Inman. He went to work for Science Applications International Corporation. Why is that significant? Well, because in the context that Greer was talking about, they were actually running a lot of the black programs, which were looking at all this, you know, alien technology and stuff connected to that. According to Denise McKenzie, who's one of Greer's witnesses, and there's one or two other people, and a chap that got in touch with me called Edgar Fouché, who I write about in the Secret Space Program book. He also worked for SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation. Have you ever heard of that company?
No.
No. Well, the weird thing is, talking about aliens and UFOs and stuff, their name comes up, and guess where else it comes up? 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
They were in charge, that company was in charge of the Ground Zero security the day after 9/11, and they say so on their website that they helped set up communications mass. And one of Science Applications International Corporation's areas of research is directed energy weapons, and the other one is psychological operations.
Can see how they could go hand in hand.
Yeah. So I talk about these things. Dr. Judy Wood was talking about these things in 2007. In fact, she took them to court. She took Science Applications International to court because they helped to compile the technical reports, which were called the NIST reports, about the destruction of the World Trade Center. So we can imagine what they might not have wanted to get into those reports, such as, for example, witnesses being levitated or cars being turned upside down, which is all in the evidence. What's that an example of? Isn't it an example of levitation? Which is, what's that? Anti-gravity.
Yeah.
You know? And what about this, what happened to all the steel? Well, it looked like it had melted, but people were in the region of this melted steel and they survived. They weren't burned. They weren't killed. Obviously, some people were killed. But we've got people floating down the stairways. You know? We've got Jay Jonas, one of the firefighters. He walks out of stairwell B, you know, having had 100 stories of building land on top of him, apparently. But he walks out, as do 13 other people that were with him.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's... I mean, there's that one with like the firefighters where their oxygen tanks exploded on...
Good, I'm glad. Yeah, we may have covered this. I know we spoke to you a couple of years ago.
That's, you know, that's hard to explain, that one.
It is.
Given it is. Any sort of known thing.
So this is what I, you know, this is basically, I'm pressure bringing all this leading. Up. Yeah, but I'm bringing all this up because what you're seeing right there, to me, is essentially part of the secret space program, but not used in a space environment. They're using that technology. They use anti-gravity technology. For example, in the book, going back to the secret space program book, I've got a couple of chapters on Edgar Fouché, who was this whistleblower who appeared in 1998. And he did this talk at the IUFOC, the International UFO Congress, in 1998. and he did an hour-long presentation. It's on YouTube. You can watch it. I highly recommend that people go and watch it. And he said, you know, he worked in the Air Force. He'd been in the Air Force, I think, for a few years, and then he became a defense contractor. And he was very good at his job. He got a very good reputation for being a problem solver, getting black programs. He worked in black programs. He said he didn't work in a black program that was involved with anti-gravity technology, but he did work on the, I think, on the stealth bomber. He worked on part of that program, although he couldn't say exactly what it was. But I interviewed him for 5 hours. All those interviews are on my YouTube channel. Anybody wants to go through them all. And he said, for example, just to give you an example of why I think he was credible and telling the truth, it's where you get independent corroboration. He said, for example, and I first heard him talking about this in 2004, but he'd said it in 1998. He talked about something called quasicrystals. And now quasicrystals, he said, were a technology that was used in this craft that he said was real. Now, he and a few other guys had been told that they developed this flying triangle, which was called the TR-3B. And now you hear this mentioned quite a lot. A lot of the UFO crowd are talking about the TR-3B. But guess what? Most of them that talk about the TR-3B never mention Edgar Fouché, because he was the first person to give the TR-3B that description. And he said that it wasn't an anti-gravity craft as such, but it had the ability to reduce gravity by 98%. And it could travel, I think, up to Mach 9, because it would only weigh about, you know, 10% of what it should have weighed. And it used nuclear thermal propulsion as well for the steering. But he was saying that in 1998, and he said that these quasicrystals were used as part of the stealth and the skin of the craft, and they could use it to give it radar stealth or even optical stealth. And he wasn't a physicist. He was basically an electronics technician originally, and then he got into sort of more managerial roles. And he gave me nine. Well, he said he could supply 900 pages of documents, and I have a document from him which essentially proves that he was working at the Nellis Air Force Base in 1979. And he said that while he was there, he actually found a module of electronics which he had to fix, which said direct orbital code link, a DOSL module, he called it. And he said that they had voice communications going into space in 1979, which, of course, was in between when Skylab came down and finished. And Skylab was only going for a couple of years, and the space shuttle, which started in 81. So what was this voice communications going up into space? Now, he didn't know. He didn't claim to know. He didn't say he claimed to know. He said that he worked on this module. It was voice. He thought to himself at the time, who are they talking to? You know, he tells that story in the interview. You can go and watch it. But also what he said was he saw one of these flying triangles parked on the tarmac in Area 51. He gave quite a detailed description of this. And he also saw one in 1975. When he was in the desert on some dirt bikes with some friends. And a lot of people have seen these flying triangles around the world now. So it's just possible that this is the flying triangle that he described is part of the secret space program. And going back to the thing about quasicrystals and why I made a point of mentioning that is that in 1998, no one was talking about quasicrystals. It apparently was just an irrelevant branch of physics. But guess what? 2011, Daniel Shechtman, you can go and look this up, he won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for guess what? His study of quasicrystals. Yeah, yeah. So how do you work that out? In other words, Fouché, I believe, was being given, I think he was given a little bit of disinformation as well, but he was getting genuine information out of some of the secret programs by some sources. And another bit of information he got out was an alien autopsy document, which was given to him as well. And that fitted with some of the stuff that came out in the Roswell story. Mm. But it came from a different source, you know.
The only issue with Roswell that I see is the fact that, I mean, we don't know how Let's just take, for example, let's assume that aliens are real, mm-hmm. For the sake of argument. Let's assume that the Roswell thing happened, again, for the sake of argument. But what the one thing that's puzzled me is why the aliens didn't come and retrieve that craft.
Oh, that's some people say that did happen.
Yeah.
Greer has certainly said that there have been, and I've read that, I think, in one of Cooper's books as well. There have been instances where they come back and they do try and collect, their friends. But, you know, how do they live? You know, if they're on their own in these little craft just coming here, what sort of groups are they? Are they part of a big group or are they light years from home? We don't really know,
that's
you see.
That's the problem, isn't it? Yeah.
We don't really know that for sure because we haven't been told about how they live. You know,
yeah, these could be, theoretically speaking, they could be scout ships or...
They could be scout ships.
Or even
they
probes,
could be,
you know?
Yeah, they could be probes. You know, and some people say that these grey aliens are robots, you know, the biological robots. They
Which
could
makes
be.
Sense, yeah.
You know, and there's an interesting program that Richard D. Hall did with two researchers that work for this writer called Nigel Kerner. And Nigel Kerner, I've not read this book, actually, but it sounds interesting. I should read it, really. But Nigel Kerner wrote this book a few years ago, called The Song of the Greys, and he's not the first person to use this. Well, maybe he was the first person to use the theme, I don't know, but he's not the only person. That the grey aliens, you know, they're like robots and they don't have a soul, and they can't have this connection to this sort of divine creative force that, you know, is throughout the universe. And so he says that their race, the grey alien race, they're trying to do experiments on humans to see if they can get the soul, the human soul, to be part of them or something, you know. And I thought that was a really interesting sort of angle.
I think they're doing all right without it, though, to be fair.
Well, maybe, you know, but again, we don't know, because I go into the abduction experiences in the Acknowledged book, and, of course, many people have written about these. And there's quite a range of these experiences you may know yourself from what you've read upon. You know, some of them are really horrible, horrific, you know, the most horrific, visceral experiences you could have. Like Whitley Strieber's, for example, some of what he's written. But yet some people, you know, they're taken off to other planets and shown these sort of palaces, emerald palaces and paradise planets and all this, aren't they, you know? Mm-hmm. So this seems to go right across the board. And I'm not the first to observe this, but going back to the abduction stories, they all changed in the 1960s with the Betty and Barney Hill case, where they were taken against their will and they had a partial memory loss and stuff, and they were apparently had medical procedures done on them. But before that, you know, we had people like George Adamski being taken up by the Space Brothers and, you know, flown to the moon and stuff and to Jupiter and whatnot. And it wasn't just him as well. There was Howard Menger. I think Billy Meyer had his first experiences in the 50s. So why did these experiences change? Why have they been predominantly negative experiences since that time? You know, I asked some of these questions in the Acknowledged book, you know, and try and give one or two answers. So really, you can't treat these as black and white issues. And I think one of the big problems for me is that there's too many people are looking in silos. They're not looking at the big picture, you know, and connecting, like I've said right there, Science Applications International Corporation. You know, it's hugely important. It's a real company. You know, they're an employee-owned company. You know, you can go and look at their website. You know, you know, it's not storytelling. Yeah, a lot of the UFO movement, not exclusively, but a lot of it is just concerned with storytelling. It's like a form of entertainment.
Yeah,
and for me, really, certainly since 2003, when my interest was reignited. I'm not interested in storytelling. I want to know the truth. It's not about belief. You know, if you want to believe stuff, that's fine. I'm not into belief. I want to know stuff. I want to know whether it's true or not. You know, and I'm happy to say when something is true or it's not true, or I don't know if it's true or not. You know.
Yeah, well, that's fair, isn't it? That's there. I mean, with the abduction thing, my only... I like to reserve judgment on it, only for this reason, that if these people are being abducted, and let's just say, I don't know, let's pick a number from thin air, but let's say 5% of the people that report this are telling the truth, or even 1% if you wanted to go as low as that, then these people would have to be targeted for a reason. And I only say that because I know that I could go around, my town here, Grimsby, I know I could go around here tonight and pick probably 10 people off the street that wouldn't be missed. You know, if I had a van, I could go around, I could pick 10 people off the street, and no one would ever report these people missing. Now, why they would choose to take the people to do and not people that wouldn't be missed, or people from third world countries, or wherever, or people that go up Everest, for example. people ain't going to go search up there for them.
You're trying to understand a pattern of a program. Which, you know, if it's real, I think there is an abduction program. I think it's very complicated, but I think there is an abduction program. You're trying to sort of work out the reasons for it being a particular way, but you're just second-guessing, really. I mean, you know, you can answer the question in various ways, or not much answer it, but give possible reasons for it being like it is. Of course, some people have said that abductions happen in families, so they're interested in certain sets of genes.
Genetics.
So that could be part of it, and I think that's a possible reason. But why would they be interested in certain genetics? Well, some people say it's to do with whether people are psychic or not, because it would appear that certain people have a tendency to be able to, for example, see into the future. I'm not that sort of person. I don't regard myself as particularly psychic, no more than anybody else. But there are certainly people that appear to have that gift. What if that's something to do with genetics? Or what if, for example, there's various science fiction films and stories have been based on this, that if people are carrying certain things within them, it might be in their minds, which they don't know they're carrying. You know, certain ideas, concepts, information, which is implanted in them, or they may be, you know, because, I mean, one of the interesting things that Wilbert Smith said when he talked about his communications with ETs, the boy's top side, and I write about Wilbert Smith in the book, he's not talked about by many people, he said that the people that he was in touch with, the boy's top side, as he called them, he said that they knew more about what experiences in our lives weren't supposed to be changed than we do. So in other words, Wilbert Smith believed that each of us had a certain destiny. We came, you know, here to the earth to achieve certain things. And there were certain things which we were meant to achieve and they shouldn't be changed. Now, we don't know that necessarily. Sometimes, you know, people talk about destiny and stuff and they seem to get a sense of it, perhaps. But he said that these aliens that he was in touch with, they knew more about that than he did. So is that the case? Are we part of a larger plan? You know, are we a cog in a larger wheel which we can't really comprehend? You know, maybe we are. And when you say work for a big company, is it the case that? You know, you might not know all of the effects that you have while you're working in that company. You might only be aware of some of them. You know, you can look at it like that, perhaps. And I say, for example, I think I've said this to my daughter, that when you've got to be very careful how you treat people, particularly people you don't know, because you don't know what effect your treatment of them would have.
Yeah.
You know, you might do the simplest thing in the world and it might have the most massive effect on their lives. You know, just like, you know, giving them a simple gift or giving them a set of directions or something, or, you know, being nice to them when they're having a bad day, you know, that could have a transformative effect on their life and you'll never get to know about it. But what if there are aliens that can see, you know, that can see that effect that we have? And that is the reason why they select certain people, you know, to manipulate timelines, for example, might be a thing, you know. I don't know. It sounds crazy, I know, to suggest that, but I'm just trying to say that we're not given all the information, You know, like what Cooper said about Eisenhower meeting the aliens. They should tell us that. They're never going to tell us that. They're never going to disclose that. So we're just left with that as guesswork, really, you know, or deduce it as a likely scenario or unlikely scenario, perhaps. Yeah. You know, but, you know, what irks me is that we get a lot of these people in the UFO movement and they won't talk about stuff. You know, everything should be up for discussion in these groups, really. You know, but they're clearly covering stuff up.
Nothing's proven yet, so yeah, everything should be on the table.
Well, no, what I mean is things that are proven. You know, you know, they won't talk about that. You know, yeah, we can speculate like we've just been doing about what the abductions are about, but certain things are not. They don't need to speculate about anymore. You know, that's what I mean. We don't need to speculate that Steven Spielberg said. You know, that Reagan told him that the E.T. film was basically a true story. That, and because we've got a recording of Spielberg actually saying that, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's a strange thing to say if it never happened. Well,
That's right. With Spielberg making it, was Reagan giving Spielberg false information? Yeah, we can ask those questions for sure, you know. But that we don't need to speculate about whether it was actually said or not. Spielberg said it. So you know, it depends where you draw the line, so to speak. And I try and push it as far out as I can, you know, from what's been said and recorded. But what annoys me is that some people won't talk about these things. And I wanted to get interest in this book, and I already sent this to several UFO researchers, probably 9 or 10. Not had one response, you know, one response. You know, not even to say, "Oh, that's crap." You know,
yes.
You know, which I wouldn't mind as long as they gave me a reason. And part of my thinking goes, you know, because of course what I do to earn a living, I'm actually a tutor for the Open University, and I only mention that because the basic part of my job really is to critique students' work and encourage them to get better at it. You know, and that's so. Therefore, I want that people to do that with me and say in a constructive way. If I've done a bad job, I want them to say to, well, actually, I think you need, you know, that you could have done that better, or if you'd added this, it would have enhanced it.
I think in all these fields, people get set in the ways. You see it. You see it in, you know, the UFO field. You see it in the Bigfoot field, where you'll get. Certain researchers who will only focus on the flesh and this is a flesh and blood animal, etc. And then you'll get you'll get others that predominantly focus on the what they call the woo woo side of things. You know, these being almost interdimensional beings or whatever. But you do, and then obviously you get the people that are in the middle who are not quite sure either way. But they seem to pigeonhole themselves in there, and any evidence that comes along that's contrary to their belief, they'll just push aside.
Yeah,
you know, but if you're doing that, you're missing the bigger picture, because you're only focusing and you're looking for answers on a small section. You know, it's like having a puzzle of 100 pieces, and you're only concentrating on 10 pieces and trying to work out what the rest of the puzzle is.
Yeah,
you know, if you're not willing to pick those other pieces up and put them on there, you may never get the full picture. And I don't really know why people do that.
I think you know, it's a lot of it's human nature and its background. I mean, you know, I'm talking about this in this particular way, and you may have heard me say this on other interviews and whatnot, because you know, I'm from an engineering background or software engineering, so that's all about problem solving. So my attitude to this whole thing is I'm trying to solve a problem, you know, in my own way, and work out how, you know, what the parts of the problem are and how they connect together, because from my background as an engineer, you know, that's what I've had to do to do, you know, to earn my living. I don't do that as much now. I'm more say doing tutoring now, but before I was doing that, I was more problem solving. And I suppose, you know, I've mentioned this Wilbert Smith guy. Why I particularly liked him was he was also an engineer, you know, and I've mentioned Dr. Judy Wood, and she's got background in engineering. And, of course, so is Richard D. Hall. So we have this attitude where we're trying to solve a problem. We're trying to work out what the boundaries of the problem are, what the things worth looking at to fix the problem are, and what aren't, you know. So I think part of that comes from that. But I would say that, you know, other people can do that as well. They don't have to be engineers. you know, to make a good job of analysing the situation. And I think what I've tried to do in that knowledge book is illustrate that really the way that the UFO issue is being covered up is more complicated and more subtle than most people want to accept. And it involves, you know, certain figures in the UFO movement or disclosure movement, whatever you want to call it. They are actually working for the people that are wanting to keep the secrets, even though they're claiming that they're doing the opposite of that. Yeah. I think that's you know, that's what I've learned in since 2005. And I found that when I was working with, you know, the 9/11 research, working my way through that, and then I've basically found the same sort of thing is happening within the other fields of research. You know, and of course I'm not the first to say that; other people have said it as well. But I've tried to give some specific examples, you know, as to why that is, as to how that is happening, who's doing it, and what I think the reason is.
Mm. I know Stephen Hawking felt that the aliens, if the aliens were here and not presenting themselves, he found that to be quite alarming. I mean,
well, a lot of the scientists will adopt that position, you see. Yeah. And I go into that a little bit in the book. Like Carl Sagan is another example. You know, and I write about Carl Sagan. But Stephen Hawking, I mean, I think, to be honest, I don't mean to be rude, but you have to disregard anything that Hawking is alleged to have said, because he was just a robot voice.
Oh, true.
And again, branching away slightly from what we're talking about, but it's still relevant. And this is what I mean about how subtle this cover-up can be. There is some evidence, if you look at the Miles Mathis paper, for example, there's a couple of papers that he did on Stephen Hawking, that Stephen Hawking actually died in the 1980s, and he was replaced by a double. And I think even if he wasn't replaced by a double, you know, Stephen Hawking, he was paralyzed, wasn't he? He was presented to us as paralyzed. You know, okay, we saw his hand moving to work the device, the speech unit. We could, I think, in the sort of 20 years ago, I'd seen videos of him working that with his last remaining limb. But how do we know that those words that came out of that speaker were actually written by him? You know, did he write those words? Even if it was really him in the chair, you know, did he really write those words? And I wouldn't take Stephen Hawking seriously. But, you know, if we to draw a parallel, you know, go back 20 years to Carl Sagan. I used to love Carl Sagan. I watched that Cosmos series that he did in the 1980s. I think some of it's on YouTube now, certainly clips of it. It was a fantastic series that Carl Sagan did. And I learned a lot from that, and it increased my enthusiasm for learning about the cosmos and space and astronomy, you know.
I find with Sagan that his hands were tied. On what he could and couldn't say.
Why do you think that was? I'll tell you some more, but I'd like to get your take on it.
I just think once you work for an entity like NASA, or, you know, your position is, you know, you are governed by the rules of the association, if you like, and you can't step out of line. And we know what happens to people who do, and I think he knew more than he was allowed to say, and I think he alludes to that from time to time. So yeah,
I think you're absolutely right, and I think if you read his books, you'll find that's true. And one thing that I learned when I was doing the Secret Space.
Just before you carry on, there's another person who I put in that category again, and that's Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll talk about him as well a little bit. But, yeah, Carl Sagan, yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with you. And I'd got that same sort of conclusion a few years ago as well. But, I mean, again, I don't think it was just that he was... His hands were tied. Yes, they were, but I think he was doing certain things willingly. If you look, for example, at the way he treated the face on Mars, and I write about that in the Secrets in the Solar System book and Sagan's involvement with that, and he kind of tried to blow that off as an irrelevance, but yet it was Sagan who mentioned the Elysian Pyramids in his 1980 book. He mentioned the Elysian Pyramids in, on Mars in his book in 1980, but then he went on to try and debunk stuff on Mars later, and he was quite rude to John Brandenburg, saying that he wasn't even in the conversation about the alleged structures on Mars. And he also had this dealings with Emanuel Velikovsky, who was talking about the planet Venus actually being used to be a comet, and it came into the solar system much later than the other planets, you know. And this was, the astronomers were up in arms about this, and they had to, Velikovsky had to be shut down because he was, I think he was a philosopher or a psychologist, I can't remember. He wasn't an astronomer, but he happened to know quite a bit about astronomy. But the other thing that Sagan wrote, of course, was the Contact novel, which was the Jodie Foster film was based on. It's a very interesting film. And that's the only novel that Carl Sagan wrote about alien contact. And there's another interesting book that Sagan was involved in with Shlovsky, the Russian scientist, called Extraterrestrial Life in the Universe, I think it's called, which I reference in my book. And Sagan basically says that, that there was a sub-Saharan tribe in Africa which he thought was a good candidate for having been a candidate for being contacted by an alien civilization in ancient history. He more or less says that in the book.
Yeah.
That was written in 1966. But the thing which only came out a few years ago, after his death, was that Sagan had a top-secret clearance. And he worked on a program, and I've got a page with his name on it in my book. He worked on a program with the with Kirtland Air Force Base, where they were planning to detonate a nuclear bomb on the moon. There was a proposal to set up that project, and Sagan was involved with that. So he would have had a top-secret clearance. So you're right, that goes back to what you said about him in being involved with certain interests, but he was involved much more deeply, it would seem, than you might think. Yeah. So that's, again... But people still say, oh, yeah, Sagan was a good guy. Well, he may have been a good guy, but he did work on a program which was going to talk about setting a nuclear bomb off on the moon. Mm. So he's not, you know, he taught, he was an anti-nuclear guy in the 80s and stuff. I had interviews with him talking about that. You can watch those. But he was talking out of both sides of his mouth. I think it depended on who was paying him. Or, you know, he knew, in other words, he knew he was very good at keeping his public image the way, you know, in an optimum sort of appearance kind of thing, you know. But he was certainly very, very clever, and he was a very, very good speaker, very good communicator,
yeah.
You know. And Arthur C. Clarke, again, the stories, for example, of this monolith being found on the moon, you know, and then that, what was that film called? It was called 2001, you know. And then you look at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Do you know what was opposite the World Trade Center and is still there?
Yeah, monolith.
Yeah, the Millennium Hotel. Mm. You know, so something going on there, folks. You know, and Clark, of course, was accused, I think, by the Daily Mirror of being a paedophile, and then that was sort of quietly dropped, and Clark didn't press charges against, I think, it was the Daily Mirror. So you know, what was all that about? You know.
Yeah.
And what, you know, I don't want to go on that too much, but these are some of the murky areas that your average UFO researcher, who's maybe had seen a light in the sky, might have even seen a landing or something, they don't want to think about that stuff, you know. Mm. They don't want to get involved with that, you know. And I kind of understand it, you know. But if the evidence is there and it's connected, you know, I'd rather know about it than not, you know, for my way of doing things, you know.
Well, you get that. You get people who build people up to and put them on such a pedestal that they'll see no wrong.
Yeah.
Regardless, and yeah, you do need to be a little bit more impartial sometimes.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
I think if the evidence presents itself, then you've got to go where the evidence goes, I suppose.
That's right. You know, and obviously you don't just believe whatever I'm saying or, you know, whatever's knocking about, but. The big problem is, to me, is belief. That is the big problem. And another thing I mentioned in that knowledge book is I start off talking about the X-Files, what's the catchphrase from Fox Mulder in The X-Files? It's on his poster, a big poster in his office in the first series. Yeah. I want to believe.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah,
it means nothing.
Yeah,
it means nothing. You can believe anything you want.
Yeah, he should say, I want to know, shouldn't it?
He should say, I want to know.
Yeah.
I want to know. And yet, you know, people have T-shirts and, you know, that's still doing the rounds now, you know? And that, but you don't think of that, you see. People don't think of that. That is a message that somebody came up with to put in that program.
Yeah.
It's now gone into hundreds of millions of minds around the globe.
You should have really said, we want you to believe in this, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's really what it was saying. We want you to believe in something, but not know stuff or not know certain things, you know. And I highlight that in the book, you know. And I got a bit fed up with, because I went onto a couple of programs on Radio Derby and stuff in a few years back. They don't ring me up anymore now because they know that I'm going to give them a hard time, you know. But you know, they would always play the X-Files music.
Yeah.
They don't do it as much now because obviously it hasn't been on the telly for a good few years now. But the TV and the films are all part of it as well. They are manipulated. The people that are keeping the secret technologies, they are also interested, you know, in the Hollywood media and how that comes out. And they look at the scripts and they'll manipulate the people involved to get an outcome, you know, which is favourable to them, you know. You know, because that's how it works. You know,
yeah. I wonder if there is a, you know, I wonder if we know what percentage of people actually look into this stuff or pay any sort of attention to it. Because I imagine if you talk to 10 people in the street, 9 of those would probably say it's a load of bollocks, whichever subject you want to bring up, whether you want to bring up the 9/11, UFOs, Bigfoot, whatever, ghosts, for example.
Well, I think it's probably less than that. I think, you know, from people that I've spoken to, I think most people have a basic interest of some kind. I'd say probably 50% of people have an interest, but they don't really know. I think they generally sort of take the view that if it was really important to their lives, they would be told about it by somebody. That I think is the general thing. So, you know, if a UFO really had landed somewhere on the planet in the last 50 years, somebody would have told them that it had happened, and they would have told them it was true and what the significance was. And because they haven't really been told that, you know, on BBC News or whatever, with a proper sort of full account of events, there's a lot of doubt about it. You know, that's the general attitude, whether it's UFOs, 9/11, you know, whatever it is. Most people are kind of end up thinking it can't be that important. I'm pretty neutral on it. You will get people, yeah, as you said, they think it's a load of bollocks, you know, and they'll be quite extreme about it. But as long as it's kept below a certain level, then that's fine for the people that are running things, because they can keep the system operating as it has for the last 2 millennia. You know, we've just got more distractions now than we had, you know. I think there are some little things going on now, or slightly bigger things. Like, for example, you might have heard of this To the Stars Academy recently, the Tom DeLonge thing. You heard about that?
Yeah, I think that started off with good intentions, but
from the get go. Yeah, I think Tom DeLonge himself initially, he might have been all right, but like he was in a lot of debt and stuff like that. So it was easy to manipulate him to get them to do what he wanted. But I write about that in that knowledge book as well. But I think what they've been doing with that is they've tried to use that as a way of changing the UFO ridicule factor into it being that there might be a threat from these aliens. Because they've come up with this threat assessment office, this Louis Elizondo chap, who, you know, he makes no secret, his former intelligence agency. He says that, you know, outright. He worked for the intelligence agency. Originally, he didn't even announce which agency he worked for, so that it was probably something like the NRO or the NSA that he worked for. And in other words, they're trying to take the ridicule factor away, the giggle factor, which we know they did that deliberately in the 50s. You know, the Robertson panel and all of that, I think, was the thing that set that up. They're now trying to just, over maybe now the next sort of 10 years or so, they're trying to build up this idea maybe that the aliens are the next Al-Qaeda, you know. That's, I think, where
and
I'm not the first to say that. I mean, it was Carol Rosin that was saying this with the disclosure thing back in 2001, and a couple of other people have said this, and I think that they may try and get that going. You know, I think they're going to see how it goes over the next few years, see if they can get wind in the sails of that ship, and if not, then they'll just do something else. You know.
Yeah. I would say. I mean, to me, that's not something really to fear, because if aliens wanted to come and destroy us, they could do that just by dropping any amount of disease.
Yeah, I agree.
It'd be over before you knew it.
I agree. But, you know, you can basically convince people of anything quite easily.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
As you know. And you can get them to believe things which are even actually against their own benefit. You know, it's like the amazing thing with cancer treatments. You know, I don't know how much you've looked into these, but I learned about that probably about 15 years ago now. You look at the history of some of these cancer treatments, how they've been covered up. And for example, you know, you can get some quite beneficial health effects just from taking apricot kernels, and they do have a fairly substantial anti-cancer effect. It's vitamin B17. It's nitrilicides that are in certain types of fruit and seeds of those fruit. Yet people would rather take chemotherapy drugs than apricot kernels, you know. Or they would rather take chemotherapy drugs rather than cannabis oil, which they can get, you know, because they've been told by doctors that chemotherapy will get rid of their cancer. When in actuality, all of the medical evidence says that, you know, with certain levels of chemotherapy, you're more likely to die from that than if you just, you know, you don't have it. It's actually toxic.
Yeah.
You can get...
It's just trying to hopefully kill the cancer before it kills you.
That's it. And that's how they sell it. That's how they say, oh, it'll kill your cancer. Oh, yeah, it'll kill some of your tissue as well, but that doesn't matter because we're going to get rid of the cancer. And people take it. Mm. You know, I've got family members who've taken it, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, you'll just give yourself this poison and then, you know, you'll be all right in a few weeks. You don't need to do any of that. We've had cannabis oil for years. It's been known about for years. There's other drugs that have been invented and suppressed. You know, there's I watched a film fairly recently, which is pretty shocking. Dr. Brzezinski, this Polish doctor who can only practice in the state of Texas, who developed these antineoplastins, which is a substance that's in human urine, you know, or is it horse urine? And he's successfully treated cases of brain cancer, which were declared as untreatable by any other method. And he's cured them of cancer. He's got all the medical records to prove it, you know.
Yeah.
And yet people don't want to believe it. They think it's all snake oil, you know, because of the power of the mainstream propaganda. You know, they can basically convince people of just about anything they want, if they can get the story out early enough, with enough exposure, enough times a day. You know, they just need to get that story out. As long as it's not totally ridiculous and not obviously wrong, you know, your people will believe that story. It doesn't really matter what it's about, you know, whether it's UFOs, whether it's 9/11, whether it's an assassination. If they can get that story out early enough, repeat it enough times, job done, you know. That's the power of television, mass media. It's been working like that for 100 years, you know.
Oh yeah, well the Nazis did that.
Yeah, the Nazis were even better at it, of course.
Just communist keep repeating the same lie until people start passing it around as truth.
Yeah. But you know, people tend to just think that only happens with political ideologies.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's not just political ideologies. It's also science. It's
you've seen those experiments where, I forget the name of them now. You know the ones where you'll get four people in a room and they'll have to pick out the shortest line out of the two?
Right, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's the Ash conformity experiment.
Yeah, conformity, that's the ones.
Conformity, right, yeah.
You watch those and you just can't believe they would go along with it, but
it's
this herd mentality. If enough people around you are saying this is truth, then unfortunately we're programmed to accept and But even though we know, these people know in the back of their head that this is not real. They'll still go along with it. And
absolutely, absolutely.
Unfortunately, that's just you know, an evolutionary trait that's it's embedded and it's there. It is what it is.
This is it, and you know, and this is, I think people have got to realise as well that what we're saying about the media manipulation of the UFO issue applies to nearly every other issue too, almost without exception. You know, whether it's political, scientific, you know, climate change, it's the whole lot, because any issue that dictates how we live our lives to a greater or lesser extent has to be controlled by the groups and people, and maybe one that are actually running the planet, you know. And I think that those that haven't come to this realization yet, that there is a group or groups clandestinely running most of the major affairs, if not all major affairs, on planet Earth, and they've probably been doing this for centuries. Until you come to that realization, you know, you're going to have a much harder time making sense of what's going on, if you want to, you know, try and make sense of what's going on.
Yeah, because the information's out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, it's just to say now that thank you very much for joining me tonight.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate talking absolutely. To you and having this wide-ranging conversation.
That's the best thing, isn't it? Just conversation, see where it goes. And
yeah, and anyone that wants to get all the, you know, the books are free, check theevidence.com, go on to there, and there's a link, and it'll show you books and then free PDF books, and they're all on one page. And there's other stuff on there too. There's articles and stuff. Yeah. Anybody can write to me, you know, through there's a contact form there, and you find my email address on there. So if you want to ask me any questions or challenge me on anything or correct me on anything, always happy to receive such correspondence.
Yeah, indeed. Are you speaking at any point this year? Or?
Not much, but I am going to. I've got three that are in the works, or there's one on the 29th of June, which is at Newcastle. So Truth Seekers Northeast there. That's 29th is a Saturday, and I think it's 6:30, I think, in the evening. It's on my website on the homepage there. And then I'm doing one in September, which isn't confirmed, but it's likely to be, I think, the 16th of September at in East Anglia, I think at Newmarket, the East Anglia UFO group. And then another one at Shepley, which is in quite near Holmfirth, yeah. I think it's South Yorkshire. Is it South or West Yorkshire? I think it's South Yorkshire, but that's on that's on the 13th of October, I think. All the dates are on my website on the homepage. So yeah, come along and see me if you get a chance and want to have a chat, and that'd be great.
Nice one. Well, thank you again, and I'm sure we'll speak soon.
Yeah, thanks, Rosalie. You take care.
And you. Cheers, mate.
Bye.
Okay, so there you go. That was the interview/chat with Andrew Johnson. Very interesting. Like I say, he's a very interesting, very knowledgeable guy. And if you do like anything you hear today, go over to checktheevidence.com. I'll leave the link in the description. And check his website out, check his books out. I'm sure there'll be something there. If you found today interesting, there'll definitely be something there worth checking out for you. So, that being said, as I said at the beginning, if you've got a cryptid site and you want to share it with us, please get in touch. Like I say, you don't have to give your real name on that. Just email me at supernaturalpod, that's supernaturalpod@gmail.com. And I look forward to reading those. Right, well, that brings us to the end of another show. Thank you very much for joining me tonight. Hope you have a fantastic week. And we will see you on the other side.
Well, they've gone. Though, just for now. It wasn't the right time for us to meet. But there'll be other nights, other stars for us to watch. They'll be back.